right, ladies and gentlemen, I'd say at this point in time, with my next guest and how we're going to drive the final nail in, I'm going to say in the coffin of the so-called Chief Mark Kessler saga. Okay, we're gonna drive the final nail in the coffin. I'm going to bring to the show and share with you somebody I've grown to respect. I've done research on him, and there's a lot to research. I'm going to tell you that. In 1989, he began researching, investigating, and studying history, law, and events, where the government was pointing its guns in the wrong direction. He began publishing a Patriot newspaper, Outpost of Freedom, in February 1993. Since that time, he has investigated numerous occurrences, including Waco, the murder of Michael Hill, Ohio militia chaplain, the Oklahoma City bombing, and many other events, including Bundy Ranch. He was involved with deciphering the information that was going in and out of Bundy Ranch. He's attended the sites to investigate events. He's reported on these investigations. He also writes articles about history, the government's misdeeds, and other subjects appropriate to our Patriot community. And I say our Patriot community because if you're tuned into this show, you are a member of the Patriot community. He has continued to report on his findings through fax networking, if there is such a thing as a fax anymore, but of course the internet. And his website is outpost-of-freedom.com. We will provide all of the links, but I'm very honored that he's taken the time out, not just to come on the show, but essentially review his investigation into this character. And you're going to hear in his own words what he's been able to deduce through his interaction with him. He has had run-ins directly with this character, who we now know to be someone who participated in terrorism and helping to facilitate terrorism with these individuals out of Georgia and what we discovered through the Alan Combs show. But I welcome to the show Mr. Gary Hunt. Gary Hunt, welcome to the Peace Antilli Show. It was your first appearance, and I appreciate you taking the time out.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. As you read what I do, my purpose is to try and get information out to the Patriot community and help educate them as a consequence of my research. And
yes, sir.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, I'm going to get something out of the way right away because I want to give everyone the opportunity to go to your writings. And if you're familiar with GorillaMediaNetwork.com, you can easily go to GorillaMediaNetwork.com/Kessler. If you go to /Kessler, you're going to see where I posted a 4-part series with all of the links to Gary Hunt's work. So you can follow along, of course. But if you can't make it to Outpost of Freedom, of course, we've provided supplementary links through this 4-part series. The first part, if you don't mind, let's open up by talking about, if you don't mind, let's start out with part one, Mark Kessler's checkered past. And you've had some personal dealings with him. You've dug into his background. But let's go into his checkered past, if we could.
Well, I hadn't looked into Mark's past until the recent events. But if you're going to research somebody, you need to see what presence they have on the internet. And I found two very interesting aspects of him being chief of police. He was a coal miner, according to reports, prior to being chief of police at the borough of Gilberton, Pennsylvania. One of those, apparently he frequents bars. He claims to not be a drinker. I don't know if he's a drinker or not, but he had gone into a bar and got involved in a fight that was going on and ended up shooting himself in the hand. A friend of his took him and his pistol to the hospital. The sheriff's department, in investigating the shooting, never found the weapon that was used in the shooting. Not very good for a chief of police who's supposed to secure evidence of an incident.
So giving himself preference almost through the investigation, right?
Well, I think the government does that quite a bit. I mean, this ties them to the government mentality. The king can do no wrong, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to say it's actually quite all right. In my eyes, it was quite all right for him to be a former, I don't know what that is.
Former CIA director.
Okay, sorry about that. I apologize. That's autoplay on somebody's website on a tab I had open. But anyways, I kind of took a liking to his steak and potatoes, you know, lifestyle. Being a former coal miner, I, in fact, did not know until I read your investigation that he was a quote-unquote police chief in a police force of one. So he was chief of really nothing, chief of himself. But you know what?
Well, I kind of liked that. They did have some part-time employees that could be called. In fact, when he was suspended, they called one of these guys up to tape over the be the active policeman until when they finally fired him, they disbanded the Gilbertson Police Department. I suppose they arranged with the county or with the other city across the river from them to provide police services.
Yeah, Gary, let me ask you something. At what point do you think, as you follow his history, as he basically steamrolled and betrayed the Patriot community, he basically melded in, do you think that... based on your well-informed opinion, that he tried to do good work, he received a lot of accolades from the Patriot community, and then something turned along the way? Or do you think it was his objective all along to use the Patriot community to advance his career? What do you think?
Well, it's very difficult to tell because sometimes it appears that he was doing this all along, that he began the videos back in March of last year with the intention of improving his career. However, the sincerity that he expresses in some of those videos, it seems more likely that, and he claims to be an advocate of the Second Amendment, and, you know, I get the impression that his belief in the Second Amendment is for hunting purposes with an AK-47 with a 50-round magazine on it, because the purpose of the Second Amendment is, any patriot knows, and even some of the liberals know, even though they won't admit, is that is defense against a despotic government.
Which is why they want to take our guns away.
Exactly. Which, you know, we're repeating history, aren't we?
Yes, sir.
So if he's such a Second Amendment advocate, you know, was that a false premise that he was relying on? Because he seems to love guns. In that one video, he shoots a 50-round mag in an AK-47, a 50-round mag in an AR, and then he shoots another 50-round mag out of a pistol. You know, one of the fuck libtards video. So,
right.
You know, it's hard to say, but let me say from an overall observation, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, or, and I'm not qualified otherwise, but I've met a lot of interesting people in the Patriot community over the last 30 years. He's loose. He's what we would refer to as a loose cannon.
Mm-hmm.
He's not fixed on anything. He goes back and forth, and so it's hard to tell what really motivated him. But somewhere along the line, it appears that he got this James Bond image of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he redirected himself to pursue a career as a spy. Now, it's kind of interesting that he went to Langley, which is CIA, and they're supposed to work only out of the country. Instead, ended up working with the FBI. He was Cheyenne Combs' home, but everything indicates that his association was with FBI. But another interesting aspect, though, when we look at the affidavits, is he's chief. He's not CHS-1 or CHS-2. He's not a confidential human source. So apparently, he's not even as closely associated as he appears to be. He's more like a volunteer of information. He's outside the circle providing information.
Right.
Why else would they not try and protect his identity? But they called him chief. And the people that I interviewed during the course of the investigation on the, you know, the last 2 years, or year and a half, said that he always wanted to be called chief. And I recognized that from my dealings with him back earlier this year when we were trying to put together those two organizations. So I don't think, I mean, he's saying that he's working for these agencies, and I don't think he was, quite frankly. I think they saw that he was mentally
unstable,
dangerous.
Yeah. Very, very, very unstable for even their liking. But, you know, they don't necessarily turn away his information that, and this is based on what I've seen, is that it's obvious that he volunteered himself up, or the information that he was collecting. He found himself to be valuable in his connections to the Patriot community, that, you know, you're going to have a couple of weirdos in the millions of people that are, you know, Second Amendment enthusiasts like myself. But people that want to act out, that are also equally mentally unstable and want to go off on their own rogue program to harm civilians, harm infrastructure. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue this discussion with Gary Hunt, investigative journalist, who I have grown to respect for his work, obviously, going line by line. He's got a lot of experience dating all the way back to the days of Waco. He's not a spring chicken in this regard, and to digging into somebody like Mark Kessler. Lessons certainly to be learned here, and I will continue this discussion with Gary Hunt. But you know what? As of today, once I conclude with Gary Hunt, I think we can put this issue to rest and move on. But most importantly, we need to learn lessons from this whole experience with this traitor. I'm calling him a traitor myself. But we'll clarify that a little bit later when we come back with Gary Hunt. Stay right there, folks. We'll be right back. Okay, I've used, you know, in my interviews, and I say from, you know, in steak and potatoes language, used the term that, you know, that I believe that he's, that Mark Kessler has committed, you know, treason against the United States or the American people. And let's further qualify that. The bottom line is, whether it was intentional or not, picking up the phone and calling our domestic enemy, Gary Hunt, was a betrayal, at the very least. Wouldn't you agree?
There's no doubt that it's a betrayal, but if it's intentional, is it really a betrayal, or is he doing his job? So it's not a betrayal if he's doing his job, at least to the people he's working for. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, this whole thing, and, you know, you saw the image I used on part four of the post. It says police across his chest. I think this brings into consideration something that we all need to look at, because of all the law enforcement officers in the country, including Sheriff Mack, and I dealt with Sheriff Mack back in the 90s when he refused to do the background checks in Cochise County, Arizona, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Or I talked with him, interviewed him. But he's a policeman, and he wants to further his career. Now, is there anybody in any vocation, any profession, that doesn't want to further his career? And I think Kessler has demonstrated the fact that anybody in law enforcement wants to further his career. Look at Joe Arpaio. He was with DEA for 20 years. Now he's sheriff of Maricopa County.
Yeah, but one thing I've always learned, if you don't mind me interjecting here, one thing I've always learned, and I've come from corporate America, I've always wanted to advance my career. But my philosophy, and I used to share this with everyone, is be careful who you step on as you climb each rung, because you never know who you might see on your way back down. Okay.
Well, that's true. But if we consider that, anybody in law enforcement, do they ever step out of law enforcement? Do they ever leave what they've spent 20 years or at least a substantial portion of their lifetime learning and involving themselves in? In a sense, their integrity has gone with the job. So their integrity is going to remain with the job. And in this country, the infiltration, the subjugation of the people, all these aspects that come into play in law enforcement that we see in Ferguson or anywhere, mm-hmm. They're inherent. They're ingrained in that vocation or profession. I'm going to call it a vocation. I don't think it's a profession.
Well, sir, that's to say,
is it going to go away? Can we trust any people that were law enforcement people
that,
unless they have really stepped out like Jack McClam did back in the late 80s when he wrote Vampire Killer 2000. And a worthy read. Search and Google Vampire Killer 2000. It was written by Jack McClam. And he talks about the fact that many law enforcement officers have become the tools of government. We find that they're always, in the case of the arrest of these three guys in Georgia, the trio, they had the local police, the sheriff, another sheriff, and the FBI. But there's always local law enforcement. Waco was surrounded by local law enforcement, and inside that ring was the FBI and the BATF. So local law enforcement plays a role. Of course, they were deputized at Waco, but they were obedient much as they didn't like what they were doing.
But also at the same time, disloyal. And this is where, looking back at it, when Chief Kessler, at the time he was chief, signed into legislation at the county level or at the city hall level, the Second Amendment resolution piece, that showed that he was loyal to his oath. Okay. Those that are loyal to their career are in most cases, if not in every case, violating their oath. So you have CSPOA members, constitutional sheriffs and peace officers, and I think that's what Kessler was qualified as, and that's why the Patriot community welcomed him with open arms, because we're not anti-law enforcement, we're pro-Constitution as a Patriot community. And that's where he exploited that opportunity to present himself as somebody initially that was upholding his oath to defend and support the Constitution. But in the end, he betrayed that oath, did he not? Did he betray his oath by aligning with the FBI and participating in this terrorism?
Well, I wrote an article called The Three Constitutions, and it's worthy of note, and I'll briefly explain what it is. There are three constitutions in this country that we recognize. The first constitution is the one that the boss tells his employees, the sheriff tells his deputies, the police chief tells his policemen, and that is that you can search a car, you can arrest people without a warrant, you can do all these things. And now he's taking their word, they're his boss, they're taking his word that they can do roadside stops and search your car and all this stuff. Now, eventually, those get challenged by somebody that can afford the $50,000 or $80,000 it takes to challenge those,
right,
and maybe get it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will say, well, in certain circumstances, yes, you can do this. Yes, you can do that. Yes, you can do that. So the second constitution now is what the Supreme Court has told us. Now, there was a Supreme Court decision in 1936 called Ashwander versus TVA that's rather interesting, because Justice Brandeis, in a concurring opinion, gave seven rules that the court has adopted. I'm going to mention two of those. We will not rule on the constitutionality of a matter before us on the constitutional basis is if there's any other way that we can rule. And the other one that's significant is if we rule on the constitutionality of a matter because we don't have a choice of ruling otherwise, we will make that ruling as narrow as possible. Mm-hmm. So we see deviations in the from the Constitution, mm-hmm. And they defer to statutory law, quite frankly, in what Brandeis told us. So we've got a lot of laws now that are unconstitutional, but they can't be challenged constitutionally. I spent 2 years trying to get a habeas corpus, and no court would hear it. So, and that's an example. They don't want to deal with the Constitution. Now, the third Constitution, the one that I respect and I understand, is the Constitution as written and intended by the founders, but the court doesn't recognize that Constitution anymore. So we have these three constitutions. So if I take an oath, which constitution am I taking it to? If I'm a cop, it's to number one. If I'm a lawyer, it's to number two. If I'm a patriot, it's to number three.
Yes, sir.
We need to differentiate. They have taken an oath. They think they're in obedience to that oath. They just look at it differently than we do, and that's a problem. And that's the same problem that occurred back in the late 1700s, because the English Constitution guaranteed certain rights. The English Constitution was never compiled and written like ours, but it guaranteed certain rights for people, for Englishmen, and they were being denied those rights. And so they were in the same position we are. They were not being treated in accordance with the Constitution, which led to the Revolution and the creation of the United States.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'm with Gary Hunt, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be It's going to be a very interesting discussion indeed. And I love the fact that we're sharing Gary Hunt's perspective, his research. He's dug into this stuff over many, many years. Very closely connected to the Patriot community. Like I said, dating all the way back to the days of Waco. We're going to get through that stuff before the end of this segment. I'm going to keep Gary as long as I need to share his experiences with you. But when we come back, we're going to dig back into, you know, Kessler delving into, you know, organizing, you know, the CSF. Did he get in over his head? Oh, I certainly think he did. We'll talk about that when we come back. Okay, so this is my observation, okay? And I personally witnessed this, Gary, is that Kessler, you know, received, you know, he through notoriety and his actions by passing that Second Amendment resolution, all of a sudden, I mean, the entire Patriot community was like, yeah, this is great. And, you know, he's a quote-unquote constitutionalist, or he portrayed himself to be, and a lot of people came to him. And just like you said, his heart was with his vocation ultimately. And when he saw that he wasn't going to get his job back, he made a couple of really bad errors in judgment. It was conduct, I believed, conduct unbecoming of a police chief. No doubt about it. To go on YouTube and to do what he did, there's no doubt about it. But I saw that he was crossing a line, and he said, you know what, my allegiance is going to be to the Patriot community. But then he took things one step further, and I think it was way beyond his capacity. And he formed something called the Constitutional Security Force, okay? And he got into the business of building a business and an organization. And then we have to go back to his coal miner background. He was illiterate. He wasn't the most articulate person on the face of the earth. Had zero organizational skills whatsoever. These are facts, which I wasn't necessarily disassociating myself from. I saw he was steak and potatoes, and it was okay. But when he started trying to build the CSF, I saw that he was in way over his head. He had terrible organizational skills, and things fell apart, didn't they, Gary?
Well, let me back up just a second, because you mentioned the resolution, and you and I had a discussion the other day about the grammar he uses. Could he possibly have written that resolution?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No
so
way
he claimed credit for it, but obviously, just like Congress, he was not the author of it. Some special interest wrote it and gave it to him, and he pushed it through the council, and the mayor was very much on his side until later on. Mm-hmm. CSF, though, the people I've spoken with, you know, he used his name to start these. He had people send the applications, I think, in CSF as well, but I know because in one of the links, you'll see the application that was required for joining the 3% BOG group. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he had the application sent to him, but he did not participate with any of the CSF group leaders, the commanders, as they call themselves. The commanders in the CSF were not communicating with them. I mean, some did. BA, Blood Agent, for example, communicated fairly often, and others did. But the communication wasn't initiated by Kessler. It was initiated by the commanders, and they really didn't receive any substantial help from Kessler as far as the organization. So it appears, in hindsight, that what he was doing was gathering information. So at that point, he's gathering information, as Linda Thompson did back in the 90s, probably to sell it to the government. There was rumor back then that it was, you know, this is with the old dollars when candy bars cost less, a nickel candy bars cost less than a dollar. Hmm. But there was rumors out that the government was willing to pay 50 cents a piece for names that were turned over of people that were active in the Patriot community. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. Okay. I never pursued it, but I would say it's more than 50 cents now. And one thing that was clear with Kessler is he was getting $8 a month from the members of CSF. And so he was pursuing economic gain as a consequence, and so why wouldn't he be turning those names over as well?
That's an interesting perspective, because he didn't have the capacity to be an organization builder, and he obviously didn't demonstrate any desire whatsoever to build an organization and communicate with them as he would need to be. He really didn't show any skills whatsoever in being able to communicate with these people. But as you're saying, it could have been intentional. His objective may have been all along to gather information through the collection of these applications and tying all these people in. That's right.
Yeah. And that appears to be because we do know the application for the 3% BOG. And that application, you've read it, it is linked in the article, and it's a profiling. Are there any races that you hate? It's a profiling sheet. I mean, it's probably written by somebody else for him. It's put out in rather poor format. There's not enough room to answer the questions, but it is a profiling worksheet. It's like there are more psychological questions than there are about your nature. But who would want your driver's license? Why would he want that? Mm-hmm. He wants to know date of birth, address, phone, all this information.
Mm-hmm.
And so, hey, maybe they pay $5 if you can get the profiling information too. So there's no telling to what extent. But when I look at the whole picture and the sequence, it seems to be somewhere early on. He got tied up in this James Bond theory that he's the greatest spy in the world, and he's going to really go in and wreak havoc with the Patriot community.
You know, I'd be interested to find out. I want to transition to Bundy Ranch. While I was on the ground at Bundy Ranch, I was the first person to interview Clive and Bundy. It was his first major interview. And then obviously the day after that, on that Wednesday, April 9th, that's when I recorded the BLM's brutality. When we tried to investigate what they were doing with the backhoe and the dump truck. But there were people, as I was being told, and I didn't want to know who it was. I just had to prove myself and my worthiness on the ground. There were people back channel saying, watch out for Santilli. He's a quote unquote FBI informant on the ground there. Now, what was interesting at that time, and now we learned that during that event, this relates back to Kessler. I'd be interested to find out if Kessler was one of those ones putting the bug in the ear of people like Ryan Payne. Because Kessler, during one of the, if not in the past 200 years, was one of the biggest events for the Patriot community and constitutionalists like us. And Kessler, I even offered to have him flown out to Nevada, and he wiggled his way out of it. But while all along trying to gather intel remotely from his location in Pennsylvania, were you able to gather that information? Because he never did show up at Bundy Ranch.
Well, I think I got some from you and some from other people. There were occasional calls from him where he was, how many people you got there? You need people. He was couching the questions in, you know, like I'm going to help, but I don't know that he sent anybody there. But he was trying to gather information on, apparently, what was on there. But, you know, this is back in people's minds, what, 7-8 months. And so I can't get a clear picture of what exactly he was asking for at the time, because it was, face it, it was a rather hectic period.
It was very hectic. He resisted coming and never did show up. And there was some conflict on the ground associated with members of his CSF organization, interestingly enough. So we take note of that. But, you know, he still stayed in the game. How he remained connected to the Patriot community through OMD, and that's Operation Mutual Defense, right?
Right. OMA had a serious flaw. I had a partnership with a guy once. We were equal partners in a business, and it doesn't work very well when you have to make a decision because there's no majority. So, and Jerry Bruckhart and Ryan were at odds on a number of things, most significantly when the OMA obligation at the Bundy Ranch was over with.
You know, let's hold that thought. Stay right there. We're going to come back and talk about, as we transition away from Bundy Ranch, of which this Mark Kessler guy gathering intel from his little bunker in Pennsylvania, refusing to even be paid to come out to Bundy Ranch, refused to do that. And then he obviously wreaked havoc upon the organization that was founded to really step up the organizational process should another Bundy Ranch occur. We'll talk about that with Gary Hunt and what Chief Kessler did to try to really just destroy the entire organization. Gary had personal interaction with him. He'll talk about that right after this. All right, so I may be stating the obvious to some of you, but I'm going to say this to all of you. All right, why are we doing this? Is it to pick on an individual like Mark Kessler? No, that man is down, and I would shove the boot in the back of his neck, okay? I would do that. I would shove my boot exactly where the sun don't shine with respect to this guy. But the purpose of this, I guess, conclusion of this investigation is it needs to be a lesson learned for all members of the Patriot community. It has to be. We need to analyze an individual like Kessler, who I believe is he your stereotypical, confidential FBI informant. No, he's too stupid to ever work for the FBI. Okay. Would they accept his volunteer information? Sure. This guy is just an absolute train wreck, though. He's never going to work for the FBI. The dude can't even complete a full sentence. But we're doing this so that all patriots in this, I say revolution, this constitutional restoration, our efforts to restore our constitutional republic, can learn from this. Now, Gary, there's a lesson to be learned for you as well, as you founded, you helped with the founding of OMD. How did Kessler come to you? Why would you ever bring somebody like that, especially with all of your experience and your wisdom? Why would you bring somebody like that into your camp?
Well, first, let me address what you just said. The reason I wrote this article wasn't to trash Kessler. It was because something unique in the Patriot community in this decade occurred. And that was somebody became a hero, like Bo Grides did back in the 90s, and everybody attached themselves to him. And when he turned, I had suspicions. I had a disregard for him, I should say. Not yep. suspicions, but a serious disregard for him. But I wrote the series because there's something we can learn from this, and that's the point of the series. I'm not out to trash somebody. Mm-hmm. But Ryan and Jerry had finally agreed. Ryan, actually, I talked about, getting a board so that they could make decisions, say a five-member board, even before the Bundy Ranch. And when Ryan was driving to Nevada, I was on the phone with him talking about it again. But Jerry didn't like the idea. Ryan was receptive to it. Jerry didn't like it, so that was it. OMA was the two of them. It became apparent, though, later, and so we just finally Ryan called Jerry and said, look, I want to break up. You can keep the OMA name. We'd already talked about OMD as the more appropriate because militias for defense. Mm-hmm. OMD is a name. Jerry agreed to it. They had a friendly parting, so to speak. They would still cooperate with each other, share information, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so then it was on Ryan then to come up with a list of names. He allowed me to invite a couple people. They chose, both opted not to because they have pretty strong organizations themselves. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the people that were invited in were all people that Ryan had attached himself to. Now, with regard to Kessler, it was sympathetic conversations and applause and things like that on the phone because they had never met. As you say, Kessler never managed to get across the country, even though he managed to get across the country later on. So Brian had picked this group of people. Now,
by the way, it's important to note that Kessler refused me paying for his plane fare to come out. So he refused to go to Bundy Ranch. But go ahead.
Right. So part two, his recent past, he was invited to join the organization OMD as a member of the board, mm-hmm. the initial board of inaugural board of OMD. And he missed a few meetings. And then once he got to a meeting, there was a chat conversation going on. It was initiated by Mike Fry and involved members of both OMD and BTFA. There were two organizations starting, and I guess understanding BTFA might be appropriate to this. So you can understand how potentially powerful these sister organizations would be. Bear True Faith and Allegiance, BTFA. Bear True Faith and Allegiance is out of the oath that military people take. I'm not sure if it's in the law enforcement oath or not, but it was in the oath that I took in 1964. Oath keepers demonstrated their incompetence and their lack of commitment to their task. Their task was to protect the Bundys, but their concern seemed to be to protect themselves. As has been pointed out by a number of people, over 75% of the people in Oath Keepers are law enforcement people. And I've had a problem with the idea of law enforcement in the Patriot community for a long, very long time. I've seen too many law enforcement infiltrators in organizations back in the 90s even. But BTFA then was to catch the people, especially the ex-military, that were really upset over the drone strike deal at the Bundy Ranch. Mm-hmm. And so we were going to start the BTFA as catching the people leaving Oath Keepers, as well as other military personnel. And we even had a provision in there that somebody that had not served in the military could take the oath in front of a notary, send that notarized copy of the oath in, and he now is an Oath Keeper. He has taken it in front of a notary. Now, the purpose of BTFA, though, primarily was to raise funds. That way, if OMD raised the funds and OMD came under scrutiny by the government, they could attach the bank account. But if BTFA did, like Oath Keepers, raise the funds, then, you know, there's no direct tie. There's an indirect tie. Mm-hmm. So they could fund the OMD operations, what Oath Keepers said they were going to do but never did. Mm-hmm. And so here we had a very formidable opposition to the government encroachments on our rights. We mm-hmm. had the organization that would call people up, and we know from Bundy Ranch the response to the OMA call-up. And we had a replacement for Oath Keepers that would be a funding source. And so it would be very formidable. Mm-hmm. So Kessler, in the chat conversation on Facebook, started dragging me through the dirt, which had the effect of creating dissension in the group. And some of the people invited to the chat were members of BTFA and some were OMD. So basically, because of the respect for Chief Mark Kessler, these people accepted him being a policeman and all that. He should have access to this information, that I was outed as a government agent by him, as he claimed. And people didn't want to believe the truth about it. I had posted a link to a radio show that we had done 2 years ago. This is based on Bill Cooper's accusation that I was John Doe 4. And two or three years ago, we did a radio show on Randy Mack's You Have Tread on Me radio, mm-hmm. where Larry Becraft, who some people recognize the name, he's a fairly prominent Patriot attorney. He doesn't have a very good win record because he's fighting the government, but he sticks to statutory law, so that's probably why. Mm-hmm. But I was with Larry on April 19th, 1993, or 95. In Orlando, Florida, at the Huey Building. A friend of ours was had a hearing that an arraignment hearing that day, and so we were all down at the courthouse from about 8:30 to about 11 o'clock. And as Larry said in the radio show program, I must have had one of those Star Trek transporters to be able to get back and forth between Oklahoma City and Orlando.
Right.
So it laid to rest. Finally, I'd been dealing with it piecemeal over those nearly 17 years.
Push the pause button real quick. I need to share something with you I've never shared with you before.
Okay.
And I'm going to add a little bit more to this. I did my own independent investigation. At the time, there were I think I attended the first conference call, okay, for OMD. And I just sat in. I mean, if there was something that I could contribute, you know, if I'm just a hell-raising radio talk show host that was involved in Bundy Ranch, if that was my contribution, that was great. And I sat in on the conference call. The reason why I didn't ever went to the second conference call, guess why? Because Kessler was back channel telling me not to associate with you guys, mainly because of you. That prompted my investigation, independent, okay, all on my own. And that's when I discovered what Bill Cooper had said and how he actually made a mistake, and followed up by digging into what you just described, is that you had an alibi, that Bill Cooper may have made a mistake. And now I have since, in speaking with you, found out that, in fact, there was a mistake made that Bill Cooper may have gotten his information from a government source. Now, one more thing that I need to bring up that's important is that that's why you were the person that I knew would understand the position that I've been in with these false accusations after the hacking that was done to me, because the worst thing that could ever be done to a radio talk show host in the Patriot community is to hang the FBI informant thing over my head. And that's why I went to you, and I gave you all of my documents. I've even given other members of the Patriot community, my social security number. You can check my full background. And that's why I went to you, Gary. So after a full vetting through that whole thing. But Kessler was the one that was in there yelling and screaming at everybody, talking about you being John Doe number 4. And he was trying to bust things up. So he was behind the scenes. You never knew this. I never told you this before. He was behind the scenes trying to bust up OMD. Another noteworthy event that took place as we learn more about Chief Kessler.
Well, I'm not surprised. I know that he had gone back channel to other people. I did not bring the conversations up except to the extent in the series of emails that addressed the subsequent conversations on the conference calls.
But because, he was very disruptive.
I can't prove a conference call. They're not recorded. If I don't have evidence, I can't say it. That's quite simply how I work.
Right. But I was working with, because he was on, he was on GMN. He was doing a radio show. That was my interaction with him. But this is what we can say, is that he was very, very disruptive to the founding phases of OMD. That is a fact. He was very disruptive. I know this personally and firsthand. I never attended the second conference call as a result of his recommendation not to. But thankfully, I did my own digging on my own, independent of what Kessler was doing. But listen, cool. We're going to, at the top of the hour here, we're going to take a break. We're going to go to the top of the hour news break. We have about 6 minutes. 6 or 7 minutes. So just take a break. Will you join me over the top of the hour? You still have time, right?
Oh, I still have time, yes.
Okay, good, because we've got more to talk about here with Gary Hunt. Gary Hunt, man, if you go to his website, you take a look at his writings, his work, we have a lot to learn from this man that has been in the Patriot community, no doubt about it. And that's why I'm sharing what he has done. His history speaks all for itself. His writings are something that I recommend you go to it at his website, Outpost of Freedom. We'll be back with Gary Hunt after the top of the hour news break. All right, Gary, there's a lot of minutia, okay? A lot to be learned, and we're going to get in this episode, we'll get out as much as we can, and then we need to move on. You've got it very well documented. If somebody wants to see, you can go look up Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom, or if you're on GorillaMediaNetwork.com, you can go to /Kessler and see all of the links and all four parts listed there. So listen, let's just bring us up to speed here. So we have an individual who submitted a Second Amendment resolution to a city council that attracted a lot of attention from the Patriot community, those constitutionalists that law-abiding citizens. Almost every Patriot I've ever come into contact with is constitutional, lawful, wants what's right for our nation, wants to restore us back to the third constitution, okay, the one that applies there, and really took a liking to this guy who was in law enforcement, presented himself as a constitutional law enforcement official, constitutional peace officer, and then from there just wreaked havoc at every step along the way. If we could, let's proceed on. His disruption of what was going on with OMD is where we left off. Let's touch on that and then move on to the present time as to what he's done. Go ahead.
Well, let's see. I'm going to back up about 41 years for just a minute to give a little background. In 1973, I got explaining where I got this. A fellow named Mark Florup was an aide to Congressman George Hansen, who was went against the IRS and ended up in prison. He was a congressman. Mark Florup, when I went through Washington, gave me a copy of this letter, and it was February 26, 1973. It was to the participants in conference on the tax rebellion movement, Western region. And the action items in this summation of the meeting pointed out some interesting things. One, maintain the initiative in the attack on the tax rebels. Now, when I say tax rebels, understand that that was then. Number two, know their plans before they arrive at our door to execute them. Number three, identify the leaders of the movement and concentrate on them. Number four, have a plan of action in coordination with the region rather than hit and miss defensive reactions. Five, continue to step up the infiltration in depth of the movement. Six, use all available federal, state, and local laws. Seven, use port type cases to go after them. Eight, wage a campaign to educate U.S. attorneys and federal judges with the importance of prison sentences in all, on all cases. So that's 41 years ago, the IRS dealing with the tax movement then, which was 99% of the patriot community until Waco. In those 41 years, they have perfected those plans. And we can see from other things that one of the elements when they go after the leaders is to either get them thrown in jail on state, local, or federal laws, or discredit them. Discredit them. Now, a coal miner is not very adept at being discreet in discrediting people. He was rather blatant. But I wanted to bring that up because we know that the government has a history of 41 years. Actually, we can go further. There's an article, Provoca, on my webpage that was written by the University of Chicago, and it dealt with infiltration into the anti-war movement back in the 60s, where the government actually set up some of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, chapters around the country so they could control the input into those chapters and affect the people. So this infiltration into the civilian life goes, you know, the rights of the citizens in this country does go back to the anti-war days.
And they just they can adapt those same exact strategies and techniques that just about any other movement, except now they've got decades of experience in busting them up.
Right. They perfected their tools, and we've got to get ahead of them. And well, at Bundy Ranch, I wrote The Battle Continues. One of the last articles I wrote during it. And that's when I realized the psychological warfare had become the battlefield at this point in time. And so these are the tools that we can expect to be used against us. So let's see, you brought us up to, we've got the disruption of the OMD and BTFA. There, we'll get back to that in the future. And try and reestablish those organizations. I don't think the time is right now because we've got to do a better job of vetting who participates in these organizations. And it has to be people that have proven themselves, not by videos or, you know, like Kessler. We've got a lot to learn from this episode.
Yes, sir. But, and you know what? And that includes me, sir. And you know that I've offered myself up if there's any. As a matter of fact, I know that you know how to comb through the reams of data that clearly exonerate me. And I've asked you. And you know what? I want you to hold me to account. And you're right. The most important thing that we can do is vet the people that are in the Patriot community. And, of course, recognize the ones that have been vetted. Right.
I think we need to, and that vetting in some cases, especially to the public figures, needs to be in public, in an organization, in a militia or any other CSF or 3% BOG or any other organization. They've got to look at their vetting process. And, you know, we can talk about that a little later. I've got some ideas on that, but something has to be done to make sure that what happened to Kevin Massey, for example, when John Forrester was the informant.
Now, explain who Kevin Robert Massey Beecher. Is, but if you don't mind, for the listening audience that don't know who Kevin Massey is. I know who he is. I was actually with him in San Antonio when we proceeded down to the border when I was involved in meeting up with the citizens militia and embedding on a night op border mission. Mr. Massey was involved in an incident. Describe that. Down on the border.
Kevin Massey was involved for 4 months in Camp Lone Star on Rusty Monsey's property. And I've spoken with Rusty and a number of people down there, and I'm in nearly daily contact with Kevin. What happened is there was a shooting incident. Three of them were out on patrol. They were separated. They had spread out. And John Forrester, who went by the name of Jesus, the nickname of or moniker of Jesus, was separate from the other two. And all of a sudden, they heard gunfire. Five rounds were fired, two, then two, and then one. The story is that they were about 30 feet apart, and Hernandez, I think his name was, the Border Protection Service agent, said something. Forrester turned around, saw that he had his gun out. Forrester put his gun on the ground. He didn't point it at Hernandez at all, even though SPLC and some other sources have said that he pointed the gun. But from 30 feet, this BPS agent, should be trained in firearms, missed Forrester.
Wow.
But as a consequence, Massey and Barner, who were there, were brought into this little group that was going around the shooting. And this gets pretty interesting because, the guns were put in the mule that the Camp Lone Star people, Massey and them, had. Right. And I guess they may have had firearms on as well. I don't recall right now. But then the captain of the BPS said, we want to secure those arms because some illegals might come up and grab them and shoot us. They're in the mule, I guess, I don't know how many feet away. So they took all the arms and put them in a BPS truck. An illegal seizure, basically.
Huh.
So they had the firearms now, and so they wanted to tie the firearms to Massey, but they have a piss poor chain of evidence. Now, the only gun that was fired that day was Hernandez, but the captain switched guns with Hernandez, put Hernandez's gun in his holster, and Hernandez took the captain's pistol and put it in his holster. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if an audit was done. But however, the sheriff and the FBI showed up together. It kind of a coincidence. The FBI just happened to respond with the sheriff at that time. But from a legal standpoint, the BPS has to do a officer-involved shooting report. The sheriff has to do one, and the FBI has to do one. We haven't been able to get those reports yet. Also, there should have been an audit, firearms audit, which, counts how many shells he had, how many remain, how many shots were fired. They do a ballistics test and everything.
Right.
They have not been done. So it begins to appear that this was kind of a setup to justify taking all the weapons.
Now, if you don't mind, and by the way, all the details you've been covering on Massey's arrest and his legal wranglings, it could be found at Outpost of Freedom. Now, let's speed up to the relevant, and this has to do with Kessler. Where does Kessler come? Out of the blue, out of nowhere, Kessler arrives on the scene of this this incident. Not arrives on the scene, but interjects himself into this incident, correct?
Well, he tries to interject himself. He called before, or right after the shooting incident, I think it was, he called Kevin, and the arrest came weeks after the shooting incident. Kessler called Massey and wanted to cozy up to him and come down and help him out and everything. And Kevin was concerned about this, and he said, no, you don't have an invitation. Now, Kevin subsequently talked to many of the other Texas border people, and all of them had the same feeling, discomfort with Kessler. They didn't know why, but they just didn't like his rhetoric.
Push the pause button. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, you're going to tell us what happens after. Well, Kessler always wants to pick up the phone. This was his history. Pick up the phone, find out what's going on. Hey, we can give you support. He did it at Bundy Ranch. He never shows up anyway. He doesn't show up to Bundy Ranch. He didn't show up at the border. We'll talk a little bit about his escapades at the border, but he was there for an hour or two. So very interestingly enough, he calls Massey. And Gary will tell us what happened with that right after this. Okay, I'm back with Gary Hunt. As I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is lesson learned for all of us. We're clearly laying out the details of You know, not who this Kessler guy is, but what he has actually done. That's all we can do is document. And you, the listener, you, the patriot, can decide how to respond accordingly to any potential infiltrator, especially if they're, you know, if they're carrying a badge and present themselves as a constitutional peace officer. Once a cop, always a cop. They bear true faith and allegiance to whatever it is that's going on over there at the FBI. Here is Kessler picking up the phone, sticking his nose into the Massey thing. And by the way, Kessler understood what was happening on the border with respect to Camp Lone Star through his interaction with me. So I was down there on the border with Massey. So Kessler picks up the phone, calls Massey, starts digging in. Did Massey say he was asking him any interesting questions that would compromise operational security?
He was asking him what was going on. I haven't gone into detail on what Kessler did with Massey. I did ask Kevin, and I've reported what Kevin told me in the third article, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the extent of the conversation. But we know that, you know, that he went to the Arizona border, and at least two people down there really didn't like him being there. One guy.
Let's back up a second. It's interesting to note that Kessler's call to Massey was just a few days after the shooting, right? A few days after the shooting.
I think it was after. My memory's getting old, just like me.
Yeah, but Massey was arrested, essentially, ultimately. We don't know if it was a direct result, but Kessler was involved and Massey was arrested. I would say wrongfully charged. So we move on. Here we go. So Kessler makes it down to the border. Another escapade. I'll never forget his whole tirade about him wanting to go down to the border. I was asking him, here's what I need to add to this. I was asking Kessler. He said, I'm coming down to the border. I'm going to go on a border op. And I'm like, okay, who are you connected to down there? I wanted to put him in touch with, you know, with the people in Arizona, for instance, that know the Arizona border, the people in Texas that know the Texas border. And he seemed like he was on his rogue type of operation where he knew what he was doing coming out of Pennsylvania down on the border.
But now we know his motivation.
Yes, we do. What now, based on what you know about his escapades heading down to the border, let's expose some of these details. What was odd about Kessler's trip down to the border?
Well, one of the reports I got was that a guy had been working with BPS and the local sheriff and trying to develop a good working rapport with them. And Kessler came down like gangbusters and apparently did a lot of damage to what had been worked on for months in trying to establish this rapport. He undid the work that had been done by his arrogance. A similar report from another side where it wasn't as damaging, but he wanted to come down and take over. He wanted to know everything there was about the operation and participate in it. But he never showed up. But then we know that he was, he had that convention hall rented to have a meeting, and apparently there weren't that many people showed up. But afterwards, apparently he decided to go on a patrol, and the government people had become so concerned that they actually sent a helicopter out to find out where he was and basically tell him, get out of town. We don't want you here.
Mm-hmm.
The word got to New Mexico, and I don't know if he was effective in Mexico or New Mexico or not. I've not spoken to any of the people there, but the people that I've spoken to in Texas, they were beginning to get this image of Kessler based on feedback on the, basically the border of people are pretty much in touch with himself to some extent. And word was going around, but then the way Kessler talked to Massey, for example, and to other people in Texas, they didn't want anything to do with him. So he had no success making any contact with, to the best of my knowledge, any contact with the Texas border operations, nor the New Mexico border operations. And the contacts that he had in Arizona were basically refused because, you know, these are serious people, and there's no seriousness in Kessler. This guy's a loose cannon.
Captain Joe O'Shaughnessy, who actually he handled my PSD, my personal security detail when I was down on the border, him and his crew, I had my life in this guy's hands. And he told me He said, Kessler has lost his mind. He's in charge of the Arizona militia. And he said, this guy just absolutely snapped, lost his mind, and they kicked him out of Arizona. He was very discouraged by what Kessler had done. So anyways, now let's, in the essence of time here. So all along, Kessler is involved in this covert secret operation as a rogue, I'm calling him a rogue snitch, as a traitorous rogue snitch involved in this investigation, dating back to February. But he was still honeypotting, wasn't he? Trying to collect information, conducting multiple investigations per his own admission on the Combs show. Let's go to that investigation. What were the anomalies that you discovered after the Combs disclosures, when he quote-unquote came out of the closet, what were the anomalies that you discovered in that search warrant?
Well, I think the principal one is he claimed on the Combs show that he was working for them. Now, you know, he had gone to Langley with CIA. They're not going to touch him. And I'm sure that CIA, unless you have proven yourself, you know, established your merit as a spy, basically you have to have a college degree in something. The FBI requires for their agents to have a college degree in accounting or be an attorney or at least have a law degree. Mm-hmm. So when they take agents, they have to have qualifications. There are exceptions, like I said, for somebody who has established their abilities. But we've got two CHSs, confidential human sources. Neither of them is Kessler, even though at first we thought CHS1 was Kessler because Kessler said he did receive money for them for expenses, and CHS1 had received expensive money. But as it comes out, it turns out in talking to people that the reference to chief, and everybody I talked to said he wanted to be called chief. Mm-hmm. So when we have the chief in there, what they have is a loose cannon. They'll take his information, just like somebody that makes an anonymous call to that, turn in a criminal hotline, whatever it's called. They're going to take the information. But apparently they saw him, my evaluation is, they saw him as such a loose cannon that they wouldn't even consider him a confidential human source. He's not a source. He's a loose cannon.
He was a confidential liability.
Realistically, yes, which is why they would not even give him the extent of anonymity that they gave to CHS1 and CHS2.
Yes, and actually refer to his moniker, which would it? Now, I'm making an assumption. This is speculation that the reference to the chief as the moniker in that search warrant clearly establishes their detachment from him, that he was just volunteering information. He was operating in a chat room, and they disclosed that.
They afforded him no cover. And like I say, the numerous people that I talked to in the investigation, I asked them specifically, and they said, yes, he always wanted to be called chief. Mm-hmm. So nobody else is going to challenge this hero, Chief Mark Kessler, by saying, no, I'm the chief. Not even an Indian chief would probably use Bald Eagle or something instead of chief in front of Kessler because of Kessler's insistence on he was the chief.
Now, over the past couple of weeks, there's been some conflicting stories directly from Kessler. He's went on Combs. When he discovered that we were going to come out against him, I turned 180 degrees against him when I found out that he was an informant. And we came out. When he discovered we were coming out, then he denied it. He's gone back and forth. Have you been able to establish, based on his social media activity, has he come out and admitted that, yes, in fact, he was that voluntary rogue snitch that was chief listed in that report? Has he admitted it publicly?
He hasn't denied it.
Okay.
But you know that there was a parody page set up under the name Chief Mark Kessler, and you and I discussed that, and there were some appearances in there that were kind of interesting, but I haven't followed him. You know, I had enough for my story, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, just like you said earlier, I'm done with Kessler. You know, what's important now is the lessons that we've learned as a consequence of what he did.
Let's do this. Let's take the remaining balance of this segment here. We're gonna conclude at the 41-minute mark, and I skip this break. All right. Let's talk to the members of the Patriot community. You've been in this quote unquote, I say this game as you said, dating all the way back to Waco. You've seen these infiltrators come and go. You've seen the government and have clearly identified, and I agree with you, that the members of the FBI, the CIA, they are our domestic enemies, never to be associated with by any member of the Patriot community, period. Period. I will never, ever go.
I go further. I say any law enforcement, and that would include all the CSPOA, especially as a consequence of what occurred at Bundy Ranch, and you're familiar with that. But when I was writing part four of this, I was going to go into an epilogue.
You know what? Can I say something, Gary? Gary, this is what I will say, though, okay? I will say this. I stood with Sheriff Mack about, and I was back behind the gate with Sheriff Mack. We were in, Sheriff Mack put his ass on the line. Okay, and I can only go by that. I'm not saying that I'm going to, you know,
well,
hear
my understanding was he arrived there after the cattle were unrustled.
No, that's not correct. I have
and
documented.
He was way up on the hill. I mean, this is the reports I got.
I need to talk to you
about that and get that straight. But
yeah, no, I was standing there.
I do
there.
Know that the meeting where they determined the women and children in the front.
He was at that one, right?
Payne was refused entry to that meeting. Nobody was involved in that meeting. It might have been between him and his secretary, as far as that goes. But he told other people that was only CSPOA members.
I have video, presumption that they could make determination
for the entire group.
No, I have video and photographic proof that Stuart Rhodes. Myself, I mean, Luke Azzano was there at the gate before they even opened up the gate. We were standing there in the canyon, and that happened well in advance. And I actually have all the footage. I'm the only one that has the footage of the cattle being released right from the very beginning. So he was there. He had his ass on the line. And I have to say, I have to give at least that much credit to Sheriff Mack and Stuart Rhodes for putting themselves, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. No doubt about it. I have to give them at least that much credit.
Yeah, well, not debate that, but the reports I've got do vary slightly from that. But however, let's getting back to where we are. When I wrote the part four article, I was going to do some lessons learned on that. When I started writing it, it ended up longer and took away from the story about Kessler. So I'm going to write a separate article on it, but I made some notes and I'm going to go over, these are some of the lessons we've learned. Mm-hmm. Anybody in law enforcement may have aspirations that would cause him, as it did Kessler, to seek fame and fortune, or at least promotions and awards. They should never be trusted, as their paycheck and allegiance are with the enemy. And you pointed out the enemy, and I've seen in every bust, everything I've ever seen, that local law enforcement is always a willing participant. And so I have trouble with anybody in law enforcement, period, until we get to the point that they can really prove that they're on our side.
Yeah, yeah. I would say there needs to be that separation between the two. Although I'm saying that, you know, that Sheriff Mack himself, he was right there. I stood right with him. That's the first time I shook my hands with him. But guess what? As far as all of the constitutional sheriffs and peace officers, you know what? Let them have their own little division of whatever it is that they do aside from. But we can never fully trust them because we just can't fully trust them because they can't be exposed to using information to further their careers. They're ultimately interested in pursuing their vocation, right? They have a conflict of interest almost. I believe
that. One of the 3% groups, a well-known one that I respect, and I don't want to mention which one necessarily right now because of what I'm going to say. When we were putting the BTFA together, I contacted him with regard to being a member of the board. He looked over the paperwork that we'd prepared and everything, and he said, I think it's a great idea. However, I'd rather not be on your board. However, if there is an event, we will be there and we will liaison with you. So their willingness to cooperate with the OMD aspect.
Yeah.
Was definitely there. And, you know, I would say that we could liaison with Oath Keepers as well, perhaps, but I would be very doubtful. And CSPOA, the same thing.
Yeah.
So there would be a liaison, but there would be a distance where there would be this 3% group I think we would hold dear because they are proven people.
I would have to agree with that, that there may we may be forced to, especially recognizing what law enforcement officials are automatically almost brainwashed to do with respect to the three versions of the Constitution, right? Which right. one are they? Which one are they giving an allegiance to? And there is a conflict of interest. We can never, ever, ever fully trust them.
And 3% group, when in the liaison, we would share tactics and strategy right. and tactics with them.
Yeah.
With the other ones, it would be more like you cover this area. It would be more of a giving them orders. I wouldn't want to share the strategy and okay. tactics with very law enforcement oriented people.
Gary, this is my most important question to you. Okay, and I want you to answer this in front of our listening audience and everyone listening to this episode in the future. I want to know right now. I'm never, ever, ever going to go to the FBI, the federal government, the DHS, ever. Okay, but this is what I want to do: is if I encounter in one of these, if I'm at Bundy Ranch and somebody says I want bomb making material, I want to just go blow stuff up and get to can kick this thing off and get lots of patriots out here. What I have learned through this thing is I want a network of trusted patriots that I can go to and say, hey, guys, this is what I have here. OK, these are some individuals that are about to get a bunch of us killed, and I need to turn this information over to you. How do you suggest we handle that among our ranks? Well, I want to go to patriots.
This came up in my thought process back when Joe Sims turned on those four old men in Georgia a couple of years ago. The men were going to spread ricin gas on the freeway in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You probably recall that. I don't recall their names now, but working with some people in CECOM and Watchmen, we were able to identify Joe Sims as the informant before he did the interview. Joe Sims had child molestation or pornography, some weird charges, sexual orientation mm-hmm. charges against him. Mm-hmm. So he turned an informant to the government early on. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know from the available records at the time where the idea of ricin on the freeway came from. But you've got one guy that, he's health-wise, he has trouble going up the stairs, and they're going to spread ricin on the freeway. They were just kind of bravado, and Joe enters the picture. Now, did Joe come up with the ricin idea and all this? We don't know because conveniently his recorder was off during many of the discussions. But I'm going to use this as a basis of study. If that situation were occurring, where you knew that some people were going to go after innocent people, which, something like ricin on the freeway, very few law enforcement would, unless they happened to be driving by, would be subject to this lethal attack.
Mm-hmm.
So if that situation came up, what should the local patriots do? And this comes into play, too, with Blood Agent in the article.
Mm-hmm.
If this came up, what do we do? Well, I get the local patriots that I know, however far I have to go, to get a group of people together to say, look, this is what they're planning.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do about it? And, we've got this, the other not-so-thin line, an article that I wrote addresses this movement along the line in the patriot community. But so some people are going to be more aggressive, but there's a point where we've got to set the moral, keep the moral high ground. So, let's go with Tim McVeigh. I agree with what Tim McVeigh did, because he did it for the same reason I would have done something like that. However, if I were doing it, I would have done it at night to reduce the collateral damage. And to use a government phrase. So you go to these people, you determine what the limits are, and you go to these people and you say, no, you're not going to do ricin on gas on the freeway. Now, if you want to attack a government building, yes, go right ahead. The government attacks government buildings in every country in the world, just about. But you have to try and minimize the effect on collateral damage.
And this is your personal opinion based on what
this
you know
is my
about
opinion.
What. Right, and but you're not advocating that the Patriot Committee go out and blow up government buildings.
What'd you say? I'm not discouraging that.
Okay. Well,
can we leave it at that? Okay.
Yeah. You know what? We'll talk more about that.
No, I'm not discouraging that.
Okay.
I'll be blunt.
Okay.
You know, 1993, on April 19th, 1993, I don't know how many radio shows I went on. And I think on every one of them, I said, I'm at war with the United States government. It's a cold war now, but someday it's going to become hot. I am at war with the United States government. I will not deny that.
That's an honest admission. The only reason why I oppose that, because I just don't think that blowing up a building is ever going to change anything. It's the people that are running around inside of them. The FBI, the CIA agents, the people that have hijacked our government. We paid for that building. You know what I mean? I find it senseless that we spend all that money, put up these buildings, and then go blow them up. I just think that's bad business.
Well, you might, but you were supposed to read the other not-so-thin line before you came on the show, and
yes,
I
know.
You didn't read it yet.
I need to read. You've got a lot of material to read, and I respect your honesty. I really, really do. I mean, if we're not practicing expression of First Amendment rights here, we're doing that on this show.
But the thing is, other people have moved beyond where you are, and you're moving in the same direction as them, but it might take you a day, a week, a month, a
yes,
year,
sir.
Or 5 years to catch up with
yes,
those
sir.
People.
And you know
so
what? We're not going to end on this note.
Unless they cross a line of unacceptability.
Let's do this. Let me just take one final break, and we're not going to conclude on this note here. I'm going to bring you back so we can finish up in five more minutes right after the other side of the break. Stay with me for five more minutes, would you? Yeah,
sure.
Gary,
yes,
dude,
no
I'm... I love your honesty, and yes, you're absolutely right. I need to read. What is the title of that article, by the way?
The Other Not-So-Thin Line.
The Other Not-So-Thin Line on Outpost of Freedom. Gary Hunt will come back with me 5 minutes to conclude this segment, and then I'll bring Suzanne in. We'll wrap up. We'll be right back. Now, Gary, if you don't mind, and by the way, I speak to you from I'm a former United States Marine and also a former, corporate executive. As to it relates to, like, our difference as to whether or not, we blow up government buildings, yes or no, are they the enemy? I absolutely agree with you. They are the enemy. But let me tell you my logic, okay, behind it. I would much rather have all of the communists that have infiltrated our government physically picked up and thrown out onto the freaking front curb, and we get them to vacate those buildings, and we occupy those buildings and secure them on behalf of the American people. If I can write on the outside of the building, F you, don't even come in this building anymore, and secure that building on behalf of the American people. It's a little bit different than and you're saying, and your belief, and yes, I did read portions of it, the Other Not So Thin Line, but I appreciate your honesty. So that's my point. I want to recapture those buildings and restore our constitutional republic, the third one, to the third constitution. So I'm with you in that spirit.
Well, I wrote another article called The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government. It's on the blog and as well, and it emulates what history did. The founding fathers did aggressive acts. They pissed the British off. And those acts is an act of us taking the initiative. I was in the Army, not the Marines. I have nothing against you bellhops, but
go ahead.
But one thing that I learned and I understand is sometimes the best defense is a good offense. And if we leave the schedule to them, then they are going to fulfill their schedule. Look at what happened.
And they are.
With the passing of the Omnibus Act yesterday.
Yes. Yeah.
So
we gave them one more day to operate.
And the only way that we move forward is if we take the initiative and screw up their schedule and throw them off guard. Now, the plan goes 11 steps to replacing the president of the United States with somebody that is bound by the Constitution.
Yes.
The first two steps, though, are aggressive actions, provocation, mm-hmm. provoking the government, because like standing on Lexington Green saying, no, you won't go by here. But, it was kind of an innocent gesture.
Mm.
But without it, they wouldn't have had the thousands that went to Concord or went to Battle Road on the way back.
Yes,
there's a flashpoint. We hit a turning point with the unrustling where we went from civil disobedience to civil defiance.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're waiting for the flashpoint. If we have more effect on when that flashpoint comes, we have a greater opportunity to have screwed their schedule up.
Interesting.
Now, since we're talking about Kessler, let me interrupt here. I just got an email from a very good friend that I've never met, which happens in the Patriot community. His name is Norm Olson. I think most people will recognize it. He just read part four, and he said, Gary, thanks for your excellent work. I'm reminded of Bill Fulton, who worked to destroy Schaefer Cox. That's up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Sometime in the future, these people must face those they've worked to harm. During the liberation of France, hundreds of collaborators were dealt with. It will become more dangerous to stand against the Patriot than to be one. History shows this to be true, Norm. And that's a warning to Kessler, who may be listening to this program right now.
Oh, he's that, listening. Yeah.
You will be facing the wrath of the Patriots when the time comes for us to deal the blows that the government has been dealing since Ruby Ridge.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Our history, obviously, you've been a big part of it, Gary, and I appreciate the work that you've done in delving into this this Mark Kessler. You know, it's not funny. It's a very serious thing that's been done to the Patriot community. A lesson to be learned, and certainly through your work in exposing this stuff, we at least have the documentation of those facts that people can decide on their own who Kessler is or isn't, or who he was attached to or compensated by. I believe him to be a traitor of all of us. And I thank you for your work. And I look forward to, you know, continuing our efforts as patriots to restore our constitutional republic to the appropriate constitution, the third one, the one that our founding fathers put together. But I thank you so much for your time, Gary, and I know we'll see you at the next one.
Well, let me make one point, let me refer to one more article that history has removed and I've tried to bring back, and it's called The End of the Revolution, The Beginning of Independence. Mm-hmm. And it deals only with only some of the events where rifles were drawn thousands at a time prior to Lexington and Concord. The End of the Revolution, Beginning of Independence, a Google search will come up with that that article.
Fantastic.
So I do thank you for the opportunity to let us discuss this. You know, we've discussed some of it privately, and I will point out too that I've talked with Pete. He's provided me information in line with something he said earlier, and I intended to continue the investigation based on what he provided me, and I'll do my due diligence regarding that, but I expect, based on conversations and a quick evaluation of the information Pete gave me, that I will be writing an article in the near future explaining what I know what happened to me, explaining what's happened to Pete, mm-hmm. in trying to be the object of discrediting mm-hmm. activity by the government.
Yeah, no, I would want somebody like me if somebody suspects me to be an FBI informant, I would want someone like me to be fully vetted inside and out with a fine-tooth comb, because I don't want somebody like Kessler running around as a, you know, a wannabe FBI informant or an actual FBI informant in the Patriot community. Thank you so much for all of your work, Gary Hunt. We'll certainly be in touch. I appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you,
Pete. All right. Thank you. Susanna Cole is going to join me for the remaining balance of the show. Susanna, obviously, we're going to actually we're going to finalize this this Kessler thing for now as we know it. I think we've done a pretty good job of quickly recognizing the importance of learning who Kessler was, of turning 180 degrees, and then telling as many people about our discoveries over the past couple of weeks. I think we've done a pretty good job of that, of very clearly establishing the facts and getting them out there as quickly as possible. And that's why we've dedicated such a large portion of this show to that, because we're coming off of yesterday's, we'll call it a debacle with Alan Combs. We still got a lot of information out on the Fox News Network where it originated, on the Combs show. I think it was still productive. Then we went on the Rents show with this information, right? I think we've done a pretty good job getting this stuff out there. Now we move on. We, you know, lessons learned, and then we move forward, right?
That's right. Always moving forward. We have to be really careful of this stuff, obviously, in the 3 years that we've been at this. These kind of things find their way into our lives. So I think we're learning to deal with it and then move on. And, you know, you just give it to the people and let them decide.
Would you agree with me? And you know what? And Gary was very real about us having to recognize the three different versions of the Constitution. I mean, you know what I started hearing in the back of my mind is Daniel P. Love thinking with a gun and a badge and the federal government. His Constitution trumping mine.
When you gave me Gary Hunt's name, that's the first article that I read. It was on his page, and I was like, "Wow, this is like really interesting, and just a great concept and true." Yeah. His writing is bar none. It's well worth going to his website.
Yeah, his integrity. And also, I mean, we also worked very closely with him on all of the minutia, while at the same time, you know, Gary Hunt never deviated. As you just heard, he said, I agreed with what McVeigh did. I absolutely disagreed with it. That didn't change his mind, right?
Well, I mean, you know, it was shocking, to say the least, ballsy.
It's shocking, but if you listen to his perspective, he wants to, you know, he wants to teach this tyrannical government a lesson, right? Mm-hmm. I want to refrain from doing so, not because I'm fearful of it. I just think, shoot, man, you just built a nice building. Thanks. Get the F out. Right?
Well, it's not so much that. It's like, you know, are the people ready for such an attitude? Are they ready for a remark the one that Gary Hunt just made? He wasn't a remark. It was a adamant statement that he made that, you know. But he also talked, you know, there at the end about, you know, that resistance. And I, you know, what can you say? I mean, it was a ballsy statement. I got to give him kudos for it. I mean, mm-hmm. He just came right out and said, matter-of-factly, you know, I'm not going to, you know.
But you know what? I understand he's speaking from a philosophical standpoint as well. To make a move like that, obviously, to bring this tyrannical government that will stop at nothing. Okay, he will stop at nothing to take trillions from us, to enslave us and do whatever they need to do as we let each day pass. And philosophically, I understand where he's coming from. I just have a different, you know, I have a different philosophical perspective as well. I'd rather have all of those people that, and I'm not anti-government, all of those people that have hijacked our government and are advancing us towards communism, as we said the theme of the show is today. Republicans and Democrats working in concert towards totalitarian communist control. I believe we can get them to vacate those seats, okay? And we can restore even the infrastructure back to the people. Because you know what? We, the people, purchased our infrastructure. For us to go out and blow it up is a waste of money, you know, I mean, from a business perspective. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it is kind of silly.
It is. Yeah. But you know what? I think I think we're going to find out what our 3%ers are all made of. I think it's going to be a small sliver, a percentage of our population that's going to put a stop to what's happening to our country. There's no doubt in my mind. There's still 40-something percent of our population that still approves of how Obama is operating our government. And that's a very, very sad day. Obviously, we're going to have to rely upon the 3% for the benefit of future generations. There's no doubt in my mind. I consider myself to be part of that 3% proudly. If you in law enforcement subscribe to that second constitution, I hope you do so at your peril. That we will restore our constitutional republic and give it back to the hands of the people, our government of, by, and for the people. I'm pro-government of, by, and for the people. Thanks, folks. Have a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.